Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 21st, 2018. This talk in our Sangha discussion is on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. This is the Buddha's very first sutta, and everything that he would teach in the following 45 years was taught in the context of this very first sutta. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So today's talk is on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. This is the very first sutta ever presented by the Buddha. The setting and the context is important, as in every teaching the Buddha ever gave. If you don't understand the context, and often the setting, it's hard to make good use of it.
Forgive me, it's got a bad text.
So everything works out.
Problem with my mouth, sorry.
So the context and the setting. The Buddha awakened to what is known as dependent origination, which states from ignorance through 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. And it's a very specific ignorance, ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so this, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is the sutta that established that teaching. It's called setting the wheel of truth in motion often. So for the very first time, the Buddha taught this, and he reiterates that throughout this short sutta. And he taught this sutta to five friends that he was wandering around northern India with, all of them seeking enlightenment in that same culture. And so, so the reason why I'm saying that is they all studied the same thing, and as they continued to study and reject things, they were developing a similar understanding of at least what it wasn't that they were seeking, and that's significant. When you hear what the Buddha says in the sutta. So that's the setting. And he's explaining now what he understands. Just prior to that, it's not mentioned in what I'm going to read today, but it's mentioned in other suttas, that these five folks had decided that they were going to cut the Buddha out of their life. They were going to shun the Buddha because the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, had rejected their ideas of severe asceticism, and he had a couple of decent meals because he was starving to death. And they said, well, the Buddhist is giving in to his need for sensory indulgence. He can't teach us anything. But as they saw him walking down the road and they saw his awakened countenance, they just knew that, well, he's an awakened human. We need to hear what he has to say. So that's the setting. And this is recounted by Ananda many years later. The reason why I said that is the sutta begins with, thus have I heard. And whenever you read that at the beginning of a sutta, that's Ananda recounting what he's heard over the years. The Buddha was staying at Varanasi at the game of refuge at Isipatana. This is where he awakened. There he addressed that group of five. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. So he's already establishing the Eightfold Path as the middle way between these extreme views that relate directly to what they were seeking. Remember, they had, especially the Buddha, had engaged in complete sensory indulgence. That's how he grew up. And they practiced this form of very severe asceticism. And the Buddha realized that those two extremes are not the way. Which two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects. Excuse me. This behavior is base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable. It is devoted to self-affliction. That which is devoted to self-affliction is always painful and ignoble. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way is realized by the Tathagata. The Buddha always referred to himself as the Tathagata, which simply refers back to that The one who has gone forth has left the debate of the world behind and has awakened. In fact, the only distinction the Buddha ever made between himself and everyone else was that he was the one who did it first. He's the guy that figured it out. And now he's teaching everyone else so that they can do the same. And he never made any other distinction between himself and any other awakened human being. This middle way produces vision and knowledge. This middle way leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. So he's describing the results of this path too, in very simple and direct terms. There's nothing mystical or magical, even though most of the mystical and magical the spiritual teachings of his time were mystical and magical. They were about transcendence. They were about connecting and utilizing disincarnate and higher type beings in order to deliver us from the miseries of the world. The Buddha realized it's none of those things, and he mentions that later on in the sutta. So he's talking to this group who have practiced these severe forms of indulgence and asceticism, and he's saying, you know, buddy, it's not that. There's a middle way that we can travel between getting lost in those extreme views. So the human psyche and the self-referential ego self will always want to attach itself to an extreme view because it's easy to remain established there. In other words, it has to be one thing or another. It can't be just kind of a compromise between things. There's no distraction in that middle way for most people. The middle way produces vision and knowledge. This middle way leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. I'm saying that twice to make the point. The Buddha is also referring to unbinding to wrong views that would cause all this suffering in the first place. And what is this middle way realized by the Tathagata that brings vision and direct knowledge that leads to calm and to self-awakening? He's, again, making a point. There's nothing that's imposed on us. What this is a path of self-awakening. The middle way is precisely this Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And using those words, right, etc., right view, implies that there's such a thing as wrong view, or an unskillful or skillful view. And it's important to make that distinction in our minds, and it's just as important during the Buddha's time. There's nothing, the Eightfold Path is a middle way between extreme views, but the guidance of the middle way itself is not a middle way. It can't be abrogated. It's not a wishy-washy kind of thing. Is that clear? Because often the declaration that this is a middle way leads people to say, well, I don't really have to put in a lot of effort. But the effort is necessary to maintain the middle way, the path of the middle way. Then the Buddha declares again, this is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that brings vision and direct knowledge that leads to calm, to self-awakening, and to unbinding. So in a very short period of time, during the beginning, the establishing of the Buddha's teaching career, he's emphasized the importance of the Eightfold Path, the middle way. When you read this and you read the other suttas, it's hard to believe that most of that has been lost. I spent many, many years in modern Buddhism without anybody even mentioning the Four Noble Truths or the Eightfold Path. Yet that is, the Buddha is saying here over and over again, it's this way, it's this middle way. The Buddha continues by saying, I teach the truth of stress or dukkha and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of dukkha, nothing more. So again, remember the setting. He's telling his five buddies, keep it well focused. We're not getting into anything else here. I'm teaching you the nature of suffering and the cessation of suffering. Nothing more. That should be enough, shouldn't it? Except even during their search all those years, they were looking into all types of different direction for understanding rather than understanding the nature of stress. Is that clear?
Good. So the Buddha states,
now this is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is stressful. So he's establishing immediately that simply having a human life is stressful. In fact, that's really the most important thing that he can teach, because all of the spiritual teachings are based on salvation, meaning that it's something that is imposed on us from an outside force or agency or universal kind of behavior modification system. The Buddha is saying, no, it's none of that. We are the cause. We create the conditions that cause our suffering, and so we can undo those conditions. And those conditions are maintained in a conditioned mind, meaning a mind rooted in ignorance. This is the noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are all stressful. Furthermore, association with the unbeloved is stressful, and separation from what is loved is stressful. Obvious what the Buddha is stating here, isn't it? So again, remember the setting. Why is he stating something that is so obvious to these five friends? They're expecting to hear this magnificent teaching, and he's saying this suffering is simply part of having a human life. And he's describing the different ways that it can manifest, not getting what you want, which is how he continues here. Association with the unbeloved is stressful. Separation from what is loved is stressful. Not getting what is craved for is stressful. And then he always concludes this synopsis of suffering with saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. Five clinging aggregates of form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance, are what we bind ourselves to create the individual experience of suffering. But there's nothing substantial to the five clinging aggregates. And again, the reason why the Buddha's pointing that out and emphasizing it is to reinforce the understanding that this is all impermanent. There's nothing here that is written in stone that can't be undone. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. Then he continues. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the origination of stress. He's referring the origination of stress right back to these five clinging aggregates. They originate within that form, the function. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the origination of stress, the craving that makes for further becoming. Now, again, the context is so important. The Buddha has stated that it is ignorance of four noble truths that cause all manner of suffering. So it is in reference to that ignorance that the Buddha is referring to. The origination of stress, the craving that makes for further becoming, rooted in ignorance, so meaning that if nothing changes to move our view away from that ignorant view, we are simply stuck in that. We can only become further ignorant. It makes for further becoming. And he uses that phrase often, and there's hardly ever a qualifier because we have to understand the context. Because there's not a qualifier, there's been great license in some of the other schools about what follows after becoming. And it's just this, the Buddha, you keep it in context, we either can become further ignorant or we can become, and develop the Eightfold Path and become awakened, end our own ignorance. The craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight. Once we've established ourselves rooted in this ignorance, the more deeply we can entrench ourselves, the more passionate we get about it, and the more delightful the game becomes, accompanied by passion and delight. we are now so full of ourselves that something has to happen, something has to intervene to interrupt that craving, because it's so immediate and it's so gratifying and it's so distracting. Which is why it's taken an awakened human being to realize the trap of that, the trap of sensory desire. Remember how he started this whole thing? He found the middle way. Because the trap of complete sensory indulgence is so strong, especially once we're in it, that we need something to distract us away from it. Think about the overall path, what it develops. It develops a well-focused mind away from the distraction of complete sensory indulgence. One of the reasons why I decided to do the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta now, right after we finish the course and finish with the hindrances, is what's the first hindrance? The need for constant sensory indulgence. That is the basic problem. And you can say that one thing is what Anatta uses to continually reinforce itself through contact, through the senses. Remember how we talked about practicing restraint at contact, at the point of contact with the senses. The Buddha reinforces that in many different ways, including this right during this sutta here. Passion and delight in becoming, relishing now here and now there. He's just referring to that the anatta must establish itself in every thought, word, and idea that it occurs. So no matter where that thought is, there's a self-referential aspect to it, whether it's past, future, whether it's pleasurable or distracting in an doesn't matter. There'll be a self-referential aspect in it, relishing here and now there in the self, the establishment of the self. Is that clear? And so this is all going on in our thinking, rooted in ignorance of the way things really are. So we're continually trying to establish the self in a place that we shouldn't want to. It's no fun there. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Not getting what is desired is stressful. Stop establishing yourself in an environment that is prone to disappointment. And how do we do it? Relishing that one. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of stress. The remainderless fading and cessation, the renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, and the letting go of that very craving. There's nothing ambiguous about that, is there? That's how we bring it to cessation, let go of that very craving. Remember, right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and the resulting clinging from that. And then this, monks, is a noble truth of the way of practice, leading to the cessation of stress, precisely that noble eightfold path. And then he reiterates what the path is. Now he declares, having found that path, and you remember from the Nagara Sutta how the Buddha says the same thing here. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. That's another important line. A couple hundred years after the Buddha's teaching, during the second Buddhist council, the Mahasanghikas wanted a more visionary and mystical dharma, and they wanted to establish the Buddha as a god rather than a human being, and a god among many gods, extending endlessly into the future and endlessly to the past. They wanted to make a religion out of what the Buddha was teaching. And of course, the Buddha never taught anything like that. He taught that he was a human being that awakened, and he's teaching other people how to do the same. That was it. And in order to justify any religion to establish itself as the truth, must establish itself as true throughout eternity, meaning what it rests on is always true. So, if you have a salvific religion and there's a specific path to that religion, that path must always have been there for the chosen people, right? For the chosen people to avail themselves of. It has to have a way to save ourselves. Well, the Buddha's saying this path has never been here before. I'm teaching you something that has never heard before. And that, so that contradicts the idea of a universal, limitless religion there, and also that this path has always been here, which is often taught. That the Buddha is simply teaching a path that has always been established. He's saying that this is what I'm teaching has never been heard before. And then he declares what it is it's never heard before. Dukkha occurs. A long build-up to get to that point, something that's never occurred. Now, again, remember the setting. I'm going to tell you folks something that's never been heard before in quite these terms, in quite this perspective, in quite this framework. Dukkha occurs. The thing that we've been all trying to figure out if there was a way to escape, guess what? You can't escape it. It's hitting them right between the eyes. Dukkha occurs. But he doesn't leave it right there. Then he says, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me. Again, remember the setting. It happened within him. He's telling his friend, it's not outside there. Nothing's going to be imposed on us. I discovered this within me. With regards to these things, never heard before. Again, he's re-emphasizing that point. The noble truth of stress is to be understood. Of dukkha. Dukkha occurs. The way out is to understand it. So I have some comments in here in the article. Pardon me?
Do you understand the dukkha?
Dukkha must be understood. Dukkha must be understood.
The dukkha.
Yes. That's the whole point of when the Buddha when the Buddha describes an awakened human being from the point of view of right view, he says that view understands at a deep and penetrative, profound level, dukkha. We understand the nature of suffering. Of course, if we're going to extricate ourselves from anything that we've got ourselves stuck in, we have to understand it. That's the whole point. Where does suffering arise? But the Buddha isn't... He doesn't just say, guess what, you're suffering. He's just told us, where does suffering arise from? From craving rooted in ignorance. And then he says, so guess what? If you want to end your suffering, end your craving. How do you do it? That's what we're getting to.
John, I think you misunderstood Diane's question. I think she's asking, do you analyze the nature of your, or the what's causing your suffering, or do you just understand that you're suffering?
Is that what you
Yes. Mean? If that's the well, if that is that what you're asking, Diane?
That's how I understood it.
So, okay, I'm going through the day and I run into some dukkha, a problem, like the guy who just had a text message kind of thing. There's a certain point that I know that it's not healthy to go to analyze too much, but it's like. I want to understand what, you know, what past action or what caused it, you know, if it's something that I did, or it's like understanding karma, in a way I'm trying to think about.
Bless you.
Bless you.
Yeah.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah. The answers in this sutta. The Buddha, if we're in, so dukkha isn't only, and it only, dukkha is stress, it's disappointment, it's suffering, but it's not just the suffering in this, in the sense of the Dhamma is not only emotional distress or upset. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering. Sickness is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering. Receiving what is undesired is suffering. In short, the five clinging aggregates is suffering. So it's not we can get lost in the reason why I'm saying all that, Diane, is the impulse is to analyze when we get upset in our minds. The profound understanding is engaging in the world from the sense of an ego self is suffering. It's not the things that are arising are just the it's just what has arisen in our life, but we can't get fixated on this, on the individual thing. The overall experience is suffering. I'm not following you. Does that answer your question, Diane?
No.
What are you not?
It's all right. Go ahead.
No, what am I not following? Could you turn the heat down too?
Sure.
It's in that room to the left of the window.
Okay.
The room to the right.
Here.
Yeah. Okay. To the left of the window. Just turn the top knobs all the way to the left as far as it'll go. Right. Thank you. Sorry, Diane. No, not the lights. Not the lights. Just turn it all the way to the left. Turn all the way off.
Okay.
And could you turn the lights on, please?
Oh, I turned off the lights.
Yeah. Thanks, Anthony.
Duke occurs.
There you go. Repetitive behavior on the part of someone else means that I have to change and understand that Duke, especially if they're doing something that I don't like. It's not up to them to change, it's up to me to change my thinking to a right view and to take a look at that. And that's important for me because sometimes a person can continually do something that is very disruptive to me in a way that's not respectful. And I can either say, okay, that's the way it is, and accept the dukkha, or I can decide maybe I don't need that in my life anymore. Do you understand? I mean,
I'm not quite sure what the question is. Well,
I'm talking about dukkha.
Okay, so dukkha occurs.
Dukkha is a general thing that there's birth, death, and all
yes,
that kind of stuff
and,
that you said.
And so that's what I'm talking about as well.
I'm talking about the day-to-day living of...
Yes, and is your question, what do you do with it when it occurs?
I'm sorry?
Is your question, what do you do when it occurs? Well, okay, we're spending a little too much time on something that doesn't seem to have a question then. If the question is, what do I do when dukkha occurs? The Buddhist, that's what this teaching is about. Dukkha occurs, develop the Eightfold Path, and you'll bring that to cessation.
And I was saying, I don't just fluff it off. I need to take a look at it.
Yes. The Buddha continues. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to these things never heard before. The noble truth of stress, has been understood. Now he's describing what to do with it. We need to understand the nature of stress, the nature of dukkha, to be understood. How do we do it? It answers your question, Diane. It's through the Eightfold Path. We don't want to get caught up in the details of individual dukkha, because now we're just objectifying the whole point of something that should be depersonalized. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is noble truth of the origination of stress. Now he's going through what he has accomplished in his own mind to develop that awakened state of mind. This is a noble truth of the origination of stress. I understand it. This noble truth of the origination of stress is to be abandoned. Now he's saying what I figured out I need to do. I need to abandon what is causing the stress, the suffering in my life. Then he states, this noble truth of the origination of dukkha has been abandoned. He's taking us, in those three declarations, he's describing what occurs in that you can bring it to cessation as an individual. Again, remember the setting. This is what we do with it. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is a noble truth of the cessation of stress. This noble truth of the cessation of stress is to be directly experienced. Again, he's saying, don't look outside of yourself. This is the path. Remember, he's already declared what the path is, right view, etc. And then you have to have this experience directly. It's not something that is, again, it's not something going to be given to you just because you're acting in this way. You must and you will have this direct experience. This noble truth of the cessation of stress has been directly experienced. Pointing back to the importance of developing the Eightfold Path, not just memorizing it, but directly experiencing it. And this is what the Buddha would teach for the next 45 years of his teaching career in this context. He never taught any other path or any other method except this. He continues, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. So now he's taking us through the process of how he awakened. He's figured out the path. He's figured out the way, the truth of the way of the practice leading to the cessation of stress. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress is to be developed. Makes sense. You know, this is what you need to do. This is the path. So you need to develop this path. Then he states, this noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress has been developed. Monks, the Buddha continues, monks, as long as my knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths was not pure, I did not claim to have directly self-awakened. What the Buddha is referring to, this was common even during the Buddha's time, is the notion of a bodhisatta or a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva is someone who has, well, the modern term is someone who has taken on all the suffering in the world and has put aside their own awakening until all the suffering in the world has ended. It sounds great. Most of the Mahayana Buddhist schools are take the bodhisattva vow. I did, and then I later renounced it because I realized what it was. It sounds like a great idea until you look at it a little bit, and it really contradicts everything the Buddha teaches. And I won't get into that, but the Buddha referred to himself prior to his awakening as an unawakened bodhisattva or bodhisatta. The reason why he continually and consistently referred to himself that way was to make the point that even though he was a human being that had great compassion, a bodhisattva, he was unawakened and prone to disappointment or causing disappointment, even though he had great compassion, because he was ignorant of Four Noble Truths. He was an unawakened bodhisattva. And that's what he was referring to here. Even concerning my knowledge and vision concerning these Four Noble Truths was not pure, I did not claim to have directly self-awakened. My self-awakening is unexcelled in the cosmos, even with its deities, its maras, its gods, its brahmas, its contemplatives and brahmins, its royalty and its common folk. That is such an important line, unexcelled in the cosmos. And then he immediately refers to something that was very common in the spiritual beliefs of his time, of gods and goddesses and deities and disincarnate beings that are of a higher understanding than us and who can actually raise us up to their level. The Buddha is stating very clearly here that his awakening is unexcelled. So even if you want to believe, and so the Buddha is not saying believe or don't believe. He's saying even if you want to continue to believe in disincarnate beings, their understanding is not higher than ours. Mine is understanding. This, what I'm teaching you here today, and now 2,600 years later, the same teaching, is unexcelled in the cosmos. So immediately we can forget about the idea of appeasing to something outside of ourselves. Whether we believed it, again, putting yourself in the setting back then, or whether we believe it now. This is better. With the Buddha's teachings. It's unexcelled in the cosmos. So the Buddha's, again, understand the setting too. The Buddha isn't bragging. He has no need to brag. These five folks are already sold on what he's selling. What he's emphasizing is you don't need to look any further. This is unexcelled in the cosmos. And then he says, but as soon as my knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths. Now, again, think about the emphasis the Buddha is putting on these four noble truths. But as soon as my knowledge and vision concerning these four noble truths was truly pure, then I did claim to have rightly and directly self-awakened, and an awakening unexcelled in the cosmos. Knowledge and vision arose in me, unprovoked is my release. That is an interesting line. Unprovoked means there's nothing left provoking his thinking. There's no condition left in his thinking. There's no ignorance left in his thinking. Unprovoked is my release. There's nothing left holding me back into that world of ignorance that's prone to to unsatisfactory experiences, prone to suffering. Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. Another very important declarative statement, isn't it? And the Buddha is not so much talking about future births, although he is. He's stating that you're never going to see the likes of me again, which gives lie to the gives lie to the myth of future Buddhas. The Buddha said, "This is I'm done. I've done everything I can. For me, there's no future birth." But what he's most important in the context, he's saying that there's nothing left within me to give birth to another moment rooted in ignorance. This is the last birth. There is now no further becoming. Meaning, again, in the context, there's nothing left in him to become further ignorant. Having heard these words, Kandana declared, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. Kandana is declaring a deep and profound understanding of the impermanent nature of all things arising and passing away. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. But most importantly, the impermanent nature of his own thoughts and his own self-establishment. All conditioned things are subject to cessation. When the Buddha heard him say that, the Buddha said, you are now Anakandana, the one who understands. What the Buddha is saying and placing such importance on by declaring Kandana awakened is that Kandana had penetrated the three marks of existence by listening to these words of the Buddha. The three marks of existence are the impermanence of all things, the not self-characteristic, meaning the views that we use to describe a self to ourselves, do not constitute a self. They're not a self. They're anatta. And because of a misunderstanding of those two and an interaction of those two, impermanence and not self-characteristic, dukkha occurs. Unsatisfactory experiences occur. So the Dhamma teaches insight into these very specific topics, subjects, and nothing else. And having developed a profound understanding of the impermanence of all things, Kandana now understood the nature of suffering arising. You are now Anakandana. And that's the whole point of the Eightfold Path, the whole point of the Four Noble Truths. That's the whole point of today's talk. Thank you for listening. Any questions directly related to this talk? Well, I can do it, go around the room. So, Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. As always, it's good to be here. Good to listen to your teaching. I liked your presentation today. I feel like I got the sense of the roundedness of the Dharma. Mm. You spoke specifically about some topics that you maybe don't cover very much. Like, I like the way you identified the middle way. You know, you explained what the middle way is. And I enjoyed that. I think it's a wonderful sutta. It covers just about everything in the Dharma.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. As regard my own practice, in your teachings that we're encouraged to think about our breath and in the relationship with phenomena, that its phenomena is very, you know, short-lived, and we just get wrapped up in it in our heads, and it really is a lot of nothing. It's just our imagination. So I was thinking that if your breath is phenomena, like phenomena, if you could imagine that phenomena is like a breath, and if you put phenomena like your breath, we know that our breath is very temporary and unexciting. Not something to be wrapped up in. Falls into the path of the middle way. It's not an extreme that we can latch onto. So if you can think of phenomena as like your breath, I think you can become dispassionate about phenomena more easily, and not get caught up in the phenomena. So that's what I've been thinking, but then I realise that in my thinking I've been thinking about phenomena as things to do with my sight and my hearing. It's all out there. I haven't included feelings in phenomena, and it all is part of the same thing.
Yep.
So I need to think about my feelings as my breath, that it's just so fleeting, not part of me, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So that I've been sort of trying to work and become more dispassionate about life in the right sense, I hope.
Thank you. Yeah, that's getting to the heart of the matter. You know, our feelings are impermanent. The five clinging aggregates are impermanent phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
And so the feelings are just as impermanent as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
The whole lifespan is an impermanent experience, isn't it? There's nothing personal. Thank you. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning. I would agree with everything Lauren has said, and I would also add another thing, physical sensations. They're also impermanent.
Because
I realized that when I was meditating here, and I was feeling pain in my neck, and then the next thing I knew, I drifted into some thought about one of my cases or something, and for however long that was, I realized when I got out of it, that I had no pain in my neck the whole time. And so I wondered, is that just real pain or is that just another sort of distraction?
Mm-hmm.
And it also was thinking about last week, are we talking about, you know, those brief moments where you could be completely present and focusing on your breath and be in a blissful state and how hard it is to sustain that. And I realized that in some way that's just our design, because if we had to really focus on our breath to live, we'd all died a long time ago, because it's just so hard to do.
Yeah.
And you know, so we have to be, I guess we have to be gentle on ourselves that we're all the same in that respect.
Yeah.
So that's all I have to add.
Thank you. Jen, good to see you this morning.
See you too. I think I've been sort of focusing on that space of, you know, recognizing my own reaction to dukkha. Taking that step back to say the reaction that I'm having is just part of dukkha. And I'm having that reaction because of my conditioning. And then trying to just stay there. Because I see how quickly it turns into. So if I can just not feel, you know, not have that reaction, or try to figure out a way to like not have that reaction through the Eightfold Path, then I'll feel better. And that's all you're clinging to, an outcome, you're craving. And that's where it's like, you know, even when you get into this practice, that's where I get a lot. And so recognition. Got it. Abandonment. Renunciation. Still working on that. But I do think there's something to just seeing that I'm reacting and being with that. Be with just the fact that I'm reacting. So how do I know? Yeah, for the future.
Thank you. It's what you're talking about, it really kind of relates to what Diane was talking about, and it's difficult to kind of describe.
Right.
Really, I mean, I know what you're talking about too, and it's hard to describe it, because we want to objectify dukkha. We want it easily defined in our own minds, because it's a central topic. It's what we talk about a lot. But when we're doing that, we're trying to create dukkha in our own image. Mm-hmm. We're trying to, again, we're making it me.
Personally.
And that's where we get stuck with it, because the word dukkha really is just describing an ongoing environment whose inherent nature is disappointment, which means everything within it is disappointing. Once we establish ourselves within this realm of ignorance, the only way to not have the experience is to let go of that, the Buddha was talking about here. Our minds must be pure. We must be empty of that ignorance. So it's not the individual experiences or events or anything that we're here to deal with. The whole thing, birth is suffering. Having a human life, the qualifier there is, it's not having a human life is suffering. Having a human life without understanding human life is suffering. That's ignorance. It's an important difference there. What did I say?
There's not a lot of words.
I can't repeat it either, but I got it.
Say it again.
Having a human life without understanding human life is suffering.
Yeah.
That's what you said.
That's pretty good.
That's a tweetable moment, as Oprah would say.
Ava, good to see you this morning.
John, it's wonderful to be here with everyone. Repetition is so important. You know, it's like, one moment I understand it, and the next moment it's gone, and I have to keep, you know, reading about it again and hearing about it again and trying to assimilate it again and trying to hold it away again. And sometimes it seems like I understand, and then the next moment I go and I do something that obviously says I don't understand what I just thought. You know, it's frustrating, and it's like, okay, come on, this is the answer, do it, and it's done.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that way. It's just, you got to keep going through it again and again. And I think that because of where, you know, because of our lives, no matter how much you can narrow it down at certain points, when you go outside and you have to deal with certain situations, that it presents that challenge of, you know, can I stay in this middle way, or, you know, go off the deep end for a while and then come back? And that's kind of like how I do it, you know. But that's why I keep coming back, because I need to hear it again, I need to understand it again, and it's just the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for making it.
Thank you for coming here again and again and again. Debbie, good to see you. How are you? Morning.
I don't really have anything more to add. Just listening, taking it in, kind of in the same place.
I'm glad you're here. Mary, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here. I have to say I do appreciate the repetition. It makes you, you know, brings you back down to earth, and it helps to keep me grounded and realize that the stress is going to happen, and you can't fight it. It's just there, accept it. Especially in terms of the racial disparities in this country, it's hard not to look at things like those men being arrested in the Starbucks and not take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough.
The only way, I think, to not take those things personal is to understand that the minds that are behind the behavior that acts like that are so rooted in ignorance that there's, even though the effects are awful and real, we understand where the thinking comes from. And that thinking, you can't take that kind of thinking personal. It's just, you know, it's so rooted in ignorance. And, you know. But it doesn't help the immediate experience of it, does it, when it's right there in your face? It's just there. That whole thing. I mean, that the racial discrimination and racism has it's just had such a devastating effect on the planet since the beginning of time. So the reason why I'm saying that is not to diminish it by what I'm about to say, but it's part of dukkha. And it's described. And so where does, this is a good example too, even though it's a little bit of a touchy subject. Even something like racism arises from craving and clinging, rooted in ignorance. It's an aspect of one of the three defilements of greed. It's certainly an aspect of greed and aversion rooted in deluded thinking. The Buddha describes that. He describes the result of that type of thinking as dukkha occurs. And then he gives us a way out. But even the way out, does it mean that it's no longer, there'll no longer be that racism in the world or whatever else it might be? But we'll understand it. And again, that's what the Buddha's teaching us. He's not teaching something salvific. He's teaching us how to understand what's occurring in the world. And it doesn't make it go away. It just allows us to understand it. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mary.
John, don't you think it's also fear-based?
What's that?
Racism.
Oh, yeah. But where fear is a self, an extreme self-referential view, isn't it?
Misplaced fear.
Yeah,
but I guess you can say misplaced fear is also ignorance of that true person's value and worth and humanness.
Well, of course, yeah. Is that, and
yeah, it's clinging because you're afraid that somehow what is mine is not going to be mine because this other person, and it could be anybody, can take it away, you know, or that's the idea. And so it's like the whole idea is that it's not really mine in the first place, so don't, you know, don't fuss about it. But
yeah,
it's fear that something's of mine is going to be taken away.
I mean, it's much more common to. Instances of overt racism are much less prevalent than microaggressions, because there's subtle things. I mean, they've done studies, you know, if a white man walks down the street, you don't see a woman clutching her handbag, but if a black man does, that happens, and those kinds of things happen all the time, all day, you know, everywhere, and with people that are racist, and I think that it's. Black people recognize that they see it and they feel it, and that's much more of a danger than what happened in Starbucks. And I don't know how you fix that.
I think making it apparent that it happens and the black community now talks about it, I think, is very helpful.
Yeah,
that people realize that, you know, when I go into a store, the sales lady follows me around.
Mm-hmm.
And turn around and put it to work for me.
I mean, there is no doubt and no denying that in my lifetime our country has come an incredibly long way as far as racism.
True.
But
I don't agree with that at all. This country has not come a long way in terms of racism.
No.
We are no further than we were in 1965.
Right.
Yeah, but Mary, back then it wouldn't even be on television. Like there wouldn't be
blacks on television, but the racism amongst the population has not changed. It really has not changed.
Really?
No.
Well, it's just like you said, you know, the whole idea that if it's one type of a person walking, but let's just not even go there. Let's just say a man and a woman. If I'm approached by a woman, I'm going to react differently than if I'm approached by a man, because experience has told me different, you know, under the circumstances. And so those are those little microaggressions that are common and always will be and have not changed, no matter how much we try to say that, okay, now, you know, women are saying that they've been, you know, sexually harassed always. It's always been the case, and we know about it now, but underneath, it still hasn't changed.
I don't know. I mean, I think I'm a little bit more optimistic. I know we have a long way to go, but I think there's been progress. I mean, I look at the young people
in my gym, and their friend, they have black friends, and there's more interracial marriage. I just think it's not going fast enough, but I see the young people don't seem to have the racial barriers that older people have. And that's young people I'm observing in Huntington County. You know, so
no, I think
we're not a microcosm of liberalism here. But I do see some change among the youth.
Yeah. No, I do too. And I think it's partly because of what they see in the media, that they see more blacks. But yeah, the fact still remains that a black man with one marijuana cigarette is going to jail, and the white man is not. And that's a fact.
No, that is true. It's one of those things that it's so aberrant that even if it has gotten a little better, it isn't enough.
Yeah.
You know, it's you either get rid of the cancer you got or you don't. You know, and that's really one of those things. That's the way it is. Well, you had your hand up, and I.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
No, you're good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. Again, not to diminish it, but it is. It's an extreme example of suffering occurring in the world as a result of greed, aversion, and extreme deluded thinking. Diane, good to see you.
Oh, thank you for being here, everybody, and John, you for teaching so steadfastly. I think the thing that I really is my ongoing thing is if yesterday I overcame something and I, you know, didn't take it personally and thought it through, and then the same thing happens again today and tomorrow or tomorrow. Exactly. I mean, I keep thinking, I mean, to me that's kind of what I thought Eva was saying a little bit is, I want this, and maybe that's the enlightenment thing, I don't know, but I want to not have to work so keep working so hard to get to the place of where I'm equanimity, where I'm okay with what's, you know, and dispassionate and all of that. I love it when I get there. I love it when I work through these things. That's what I'm saying is, oh, wow, that was good. And then there's dukkha happens again and stuff. So.
Dukkha was present the whole time, Diane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know.
That's a good statement.
Yes. I think that's part of what I was trying to talk about. The example I know someone who continually tries to manipulate me, and I don't like that. And I have to continually work through it.
Yeah, or if the option also is that if you have the option of not having that person in your life, you take that option. Developing an understanding of the nature of suffering doesn't mean we put ourselves in situations that we don't need to be in. Just that, you know, it's like creating scenarios to prove how awakened you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other people are part of dukkha.
I struggle with that.
There's no need to.
I know. I mean, I'm intellectually aware of that. I still continue to mess up with it. But I'll get it.
Yeah.
I am stubborn.
Okay. Any other questions about today's class? All right. We're going to get into, I've been meaning to do it for a while. I wanted to get through the course, and I thought we're going to go through a series of at least three suttas directly on dukkha, and they're really interesting. Just to hear the Buddha's words on it, I think that's important, and it may be next week, but it may be after the retreat. I still got to finish up the article itself, and I don't know how much time I'll have. I just had an announcement. I can't think of anything. So let's finish with metta, as we always do. find your relaxed meditation power. Matt has a class right after today's class, so. So find your relaxed meditation posture. Gently close your eyes, gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. These are the words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta from the Buddha. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.